I'm Leo Lyman, and it's just after 100th anniversary of George Q. Cannon's death. And further in the paper, it'll become more clear why there hasn't been more recognition of this great man. But I wasn't going to let the date pass without at least some recognition of him. The title of my paper is George Q. Cannon, Controversial Economic Innovator During the Depression of the 1890s. Amidst the worst economic depression yet in American history, lasting from mid-1893 through 1898, George Q. Cannon, first counselor to President Wilford Woodruff, formulated and partially implemented a recovery plan for the region that encompassed Mormondom at the time. He certainly drew on a generation-long tradition of economic self-sufficiency stressed by Brigham Young and other church authorities, about which many of his fellow members of the current church hierarchy agreed, helping stimulate employment during a time of widespread joblessness, helping Utah citizens regain control of as much of the region's resources and economic institutions as possible. The strategy adopted sought to use church credit and leadership to organize a series of companies in which LDS interests retained control, even while seeking and utilizing financial assistance from Eastern brokerage firms appearing sympathetic to their aims. This proved to be the aspect on which many other church authorities disagreed. Far from totally successful, these fervent efforts, in which President Cannon persisted as the prime mover, not only fostered several major regional economic enterprises, but also, in large part, laid the foundation of valuable stocks and other assets upon which the amazingly diverse and extensive church financial holdings of the later century were based. Even a few weeks before the so-called Panic of 93 began in May, Latter-day Saint First Presidency and Quorum of the 12 Apostles were already cognizant of the serious economic straits their Utah empire faced. As most of you know, the Salt Lake Temple had just been completed. $4 million outlay over a long period of time, but particularly in the last years, and a tremendous financial drain to the faithful. The long-standing conflict with the federal government, supposedly over plural marriage, culminating in the Edmunds Tucker Act, had sunk the church some $300,000 into debt, and much of the property had been confiscated and was in the hands of receivers. One of those, Frank H. Dyer, neglected to charge interest on the cash placed in Gentile banks, losing the church some $250,000. And there were widespread reports of other such squanderings. By 1891, an estimated 17% of the property in receiver hands had been frittered away for supposed expenses. In the meantime, the church had had to borrow almost that much, $240,000 in 1888 for operating expenses, borrowed from friendly banks, and unable to pay the interest and principal without borrowing more, compounded the interest expense tremendously over the next few years. Also, the interest in sugar factories had revived in the 80s and early 90s. And the brethren were cognizant of the fact that up to $1 million a year was going outside the state for sugar. And when promoters of the Utah Sugar Company announced fundraising efforts, general authorities supported the venture at every step. And when those promoters couldn't raise sufficient money, they raised $15,000, they needed $50,000, the church made up the difference. And the next year, put in another $50,000 of tithing funds, plus borrowed another $150,000 from local banks and $100,000 from the Wells Fargo in San Francisco. As the current economic depression reached its nadir, the church had accumulated an additional debt of some $325,000. Besides this, at the time, the two church-dominated Salt Lake City banks, Zion Savings Bank and Trust and State Bank of Utah, were facing failure due to extensive withdrawals of deposits at the onset of this depression. And so in an April 25th meeting of the church hierarchy, they decided to send the two men who had led out in securing funds for the sugar project, George Q. Cannon and Apostle Heber J. Grant, to eastern financial centers of the nation and even to Great Britain in search for loans. Cannon had known Lord Rosebery, who was just then replacing William Gladstone as the prime minister, and more important than that, was married to the head of the leading European banking house, Nathan Meyer Rothschild. Grant preceded Cannon east and tried to solicit funds from financial men the church had dealt with before. He quickly realized how difficult this was going to be and reported that every avenue seemed to be dried up. He was disappointed that he had to change his plans about going to England with President Cannon. Cannon went to England, had an audience with the Prime Minister, secured a letter to Baron Rothschild, and was then amazed at how little the banker and his brothers knew about Mormon economic enterprise and didn't even come close to getting a loan. Cabled his failure home. In the meantime, the crisis in Utah had worsened. Zion's Bank's cashier, Heber M. Wells, future governor and Grant's brother-in-law, confessed, "With ruin staring us in the face, it almost drives me to a frenzy." Joseph F. Smith admitted that for the first time in July 1893, the church couldn't pay its employees, even the presidency and the 12. Francis M. Lyman observed, "The pressure upon the church is very great just now. The Lord will have to come to our rescue or we'll be compelled to bankruptcy." George Q. Cannon stated, "Never before among us have financial affairs been in such condition. Nothing can be sold, and everyone's more or less in debt." Just at that point, as Ron Walker has so well documented in the past, Grant obtained a $250,000 loan. And although he was apprehensive about the terms, as was President Cannon, Presidents Cannon and Woodruff endorsed the notes, and the naturally pessimistic Grant concluded that realistically, both the banks and the Cannon Grant and Company that had been established to help finance the sugar company will have to fail. But at the same time, he noted that George Q. Cannon had unbounded faith that we'll come through all right. And this, to an extent, rubbed off on Grant, and as it turned out, they did do okay at that time. George Q. Cannon conceived of a plan he fervently believed needed to be implemented to resolve the economic crisis. With foresight regarding the ultimate outcome, particularly impressive because he appears to be alone among his colleagues in visualizing it, George Q. Cannon eventually encountered kindred spirits in Eastern financiers, George A. Purbeck and Joseph Bannigan, who helped work out the details of the grand scheme. Cannon wasn't alone in recognizing component parts, financial control of crucial regional assets, and employment. Even John W. Taylor said the greatest labor that devolved on the presidency and apostles at the present time is to furnish those who are out of work with employment. Heber J. Grant commented on how painful it was for good workers to not have any work. President Cannon stressed important segments of the plan at October Conference 1893, as did others of the brethren, particularly the sugar industry. But Cannon said home industry was, quote, the true way to build Zion, end quote. Joseph F. Smith lamented that there wasn't a single enterprise of a public nature or public character that was calculated to give employment to our people. And President Smith went on to say, "We began to feel that there was responsibility resting upon us. which required something to be done, in a small way at least, in the direction of giving employment to our people. Several others mentioned the sugar factory. Just at this time, as the Mormons and others in Utah were engaged in the struggle for statehood, the lobbyists, Isaac Trumbull and James S. Clarkson, were engaged to secure the necessary financial backing to construct a railroad from Salt Lake City to the Pacific Coast, the Salt Lake and Los Angeles Railroad. And they tied that, as I've explained other places, to their dealings with politicians in the efforts for Utah statehood. Church leaders entered a contract with Trumbull and Clarkson for them to serve as the financial agents for this railroad. And Clarkson reported that fall, 1893, the time was favorable for bond sales, which proved not to be true. The same autumn, Cannon also led out in engaging the highest church leaders, their resources and credit, for the benefit of a major hydroelectric project on the Ogden River, 40 miles north of Salt Lake, undoubtedly the most immediately successful enterprise promoted by the First Presidency after the onset of the Depression crisis. Engineer Charles K. Bannister recognized the enormous potential for generating electric power from the rapid fall of the relatively large Ogden River. After early difficulties financing, and probably through Frank Cannon, who lived in Ogden at the time, interesting his father, George Q., the First Presidency became fully involved in this power project, organized just weeks after the first in the West, down in Redlands, California, and much larger than the Redlands one. The company also aimed to eventually store winter runoff in a huge reservoir and deliver irrigation water out to the Plain City, Weber County area. Many of the initial meetings were in the First Presidency's offices, and George Q. Cannon emerged as the president of what for a time was named the Pioneer Electric Company. And he confided in his diary, we're very desirous of securing all our streams in this way, that our enemies shall not have power to control our waters or even other resources. Cannon also stated, quote, I have felt that we were doing something that would be of great benefit to our people in the future, end quote. President Woodruff agreed, and the project probably took more of his time than anything outside of his church and family responsibilities in those waning years of his life. Woodruff explained the presidency's involvement in quorum meeting as Cannon was explaining or discussing the railroad. Cannon said, what do we propose to do for our people? They're out of work. They are likely to wander like sheep in the mountains without a shepherd. We must, it seems to me, in view of our responsibility as the leaders of Zion, do something to furnish the people employment and keep them from scattering. Not all general authorities agreed that this was a responsibility that the church should take such a large role in. Francis M. Lyman opposed the use of church funds for building that railroad to California. And in Lyman's diary, he notes that how much George Q. Cannon seems annoyed when someone like he objects. Senior Apostle Lorenzo Snow was clearly not in favor of these undertakings, and he actually complimented Lyman for his dissent against railroad financing by the church. And he also expressed hope, quote, that the time was not far distant when the First Presidency and Apostles and Presidents of the 70s would not have so much to do in a temporal nature so that they could spend more time attending to spiritual matters. Trumbull and Clarkson made some proposals that were not acceptable because they would take too much control of the railroad away from the church. But by that time, by the time Cannon is distancing himself from Trumbull and Clarkson because of lavish plans and undue commitments of church brethren to pay back debts, Cannon has already met George A. Perbeck, a New York bond broker, and organized the Utah Company, which clearly replaced the Trumbull-Clarkson agreements of the year before. And yet, Cannon tried to be fair to Clarkson particularly, who was high in the Republican Party, and they knew that he and Trumbull may be able to assure better connections in San Francisco. But it's almost impossible to keep these men happy when they know that Perbeck's getting 15% for his bond sales. Eventually they will pay Clarkson $100,000 for his service as he severs his ties from these church enterprises. In the meantime, Cannon says to Clarkson, except for the divine sustenance of the Holy Ghost, the brethren must be overwhelmed by the hints of obligations incurred and pledges made in our behalf. And it's because of those things that they sever the ties. On April the 23rd, 1894, the next year, the highest Mormon authorities and a few of the secretaries and other people around the church office building incorporated the complex syndicate named the Utah Company expressly for the purpose of maintaining control over many of the resources of the Intermountain West and enlisting the influence of powerful investors who might help look out for the church and its interests in future times of crisis. An associated purpose mentioned was providing employment for industrious Latter-day Saints. Organized at a capital of $10 million, not all subscribed, special provisions stipulated that the bulk of the stock should remain in corporate treasury for the express purpose of, quote, purchasing other properties, stocks, bonds, contracts of construction, and other articles and things as the Utah Company may at any future time decide to purchase, end quote. Both parties understood that besides expert advice, the Perbeck Company would promote bond sales in Eastern financial centers. In the formative stages of planning, Perbeck cautioned Cannon that the greatest possible care should be taken that the stock given out by the company should not pass into hands unfriendly to the company or the general interests of the Mormon people. The breadth and ambition exhibited appears truly immense. The central enterprises were the Salt Lake and Los Angeles Railroad, the Pioneer Electric Power Company, and the Utah Sugar Company. It also aimed at gathering under the parent company such properties as, quote, ore deposits, precious metals, asphalt beds, stone, clays, timber, and forest enterprises, end quote. Specific interest focused on the coal beds of both Summit and Iron counties and the Salt Gardens, adjacent Great Salt Lake, the recently completed recreational facility Salt Air Pavilion, also at the famous lake, and a branch railroad that tied that to the city. Immediately after commencing the relationship, Perbeck suggested they should also construct a belt line around Salt Lake City and procure strategic terminal points and franchises within the city to enhance the value of the railroad. During considerable discussions on these matters, including the long line to Los Angeles, several of the brethren expressed doubts about the ability of the church to secure the means to carry out the project. And Heber J. Grant, Lorenzo Snow were still voicing those reservations when, a couple weeks later, George Q. Cannon stated, the final decision was, now this is Abram Cannon, his son, recording this. The final decision was reached when George Q. Cannon said with great warmth and force, quote, I prophesy in the name of the Lord that if we will be united and go ahead with the work, we will succeed and be prospered. After that, there's a unanimous vote in favor. And then Wolford Woodruff affirms his feelings that this is the correct course of action. Some present probably were relieved that the bond sales didn't come through and they didn't build that railroad at the time. But they did acquire Salt Air. The former owners apparently received payment of 2,800 shares of stock in the Provo Woolen Mills, 37,000 shares of ZCMI, shares of several other church-owned companies, and cash totaling $77,000 for Saltaire. Neither that nor the railroad connecting were immediately profitable. In fact, they leased it to a company that used slot machines and had liquor sales and were open on Sunday, and gave Heber J. Grant and some others more reason to oppose the whole enterprise. The Intermountain Salt Company was acquired at this time, and one of the interesting notes there is that President Woodruff has personal stock as well as stock that he's acquired as trustee and trust for the church, and that enterprise was moderately profitable. There was also interest in the Colville and Cedar City coal mines. They made purchases of $25,000 and $30,000 respectively for mines in those places, and even did a little bit of railroad construction from Colville over toward Park City in the Summit County enterprise. As near as I can tell, didn't make much money on the coal business. The other area that they were particularly interested in around 1894 was Deep Creek, way out on the western edge of Utah, Tooele County, where there were persistent reports of gold that's just waiting for the railroad to arrive for it to be developed, and church interest did have survey crews heading out that way, maybe partly for the purpose of showing the Oregon Short Line, which is a subsidiary of Union Pacific Railroad, that they were really serious about building to the Pacific Coast. And much later, through the Short Line, they will cooperate in what became the San Pedro, Los Angeles, and Salt Lake Railroad. Careful student of most church economic endeavors, Leonard J. Arrington, concluded the church spent at least $100,000 on the exploratory phases of these projects, and the property purchases would make this figure considerably higher. However, within a year, it became painfully apparent that the efforts of Purbeck and the Utah companies, Eastern agents, to obtain financing necessary to carry out these enterprises could not come to fruition during the continuing depression, and yet President Woodruff and his counselors continued to borrow enough funds to not delay these enterprises they started. It's doubtful if the undertakings could have continued if they hadn't secured a better source of financial support. They'd been disappointed in Trumbull and Clarkson in 1893 and Purbeck in 94, but they did find in 95 the so-called Rubber King from Providence, Rhode Island, Joseph Bannigan, who entered into negotiations to purchase $360,000 of sugar stock, which would enable them, the company, the Utah Sugar Company, to fund its other debts. As Brother Arrington has said, this sale marked the turning point in the financial standing of the sugar company. Thereafter, it was able to meet all its outstanding accounts. It was even able to loan the church some money within a couple years. At that time, the irrepressible George Q. Cannon reported to his brethren that that prospects had never been so bright financially for them as they were at the present time. He believed doors were being opened so that the interests of the saints could be accomplished. 2 months later, Apostle Grant quoted Cannon saying he had unbounded faith that there were very good times coming for the Latter-day Saints in financial matters. Those less initiated into his recovery plan were doubtless skeptical, even at this juncture, that prospects were quite so propitious. Soon after Bannigan offered to invest $1,200,000 in the Ogden Electric Power and Irrigation Company as well. As pointed evidence that George Q. Cannon served as the leading instigator and strategist of the church economic undertakings at the time, President Woodruff stated, "We could not decide until President Cannon returned home from an irrigation congress in Omaha whether to accept this admittedly attractive Bennigan offer, which when Cannon came back, they did enter into. Bennigan came to Utah in late February 1896 and attended meetings where they organized the Pioneer Electric at a capital of $2 million. And the Eastern financier's advice clearly influenced the form the corporate financial structure took. Bennigan took the entire block of electric company bonds, which were to mature at four-year intervals through 1916, although there were in the notes that I've seen in the original agreements stipulations that the church leaders and their Utah associates could regain full control of the power and irrigation company by paying the indebtedness off sooner. When the presidency received reports that Bennigan's legal disputes with the rubber company he had been associated with might prevent completion of the loan payments to them, he telegraphed to assure that in the lawsuits he had ended up on top. President Woodruff said in his diary, "Those are our feelings concerning him, that he's on top." At the time of the initial Bennigan agreements, the aged church leader exclaimed, "The Ogden project, quote, will be one of the most important improvements in the state," which had just been created that year. Utah had just been made a state. Bennigan died soon after. The massive enterprise he underwrote during this crucial formative stage of so much of Utah economic development essentially assured the success, particularly of the sugar and electric power companies, certainly the most outstanding ventures of the era, and was also of some assistance in tiding the projected railroad to the Pacific through its crisis years. It's amazing that the man so pivotal in the process of Utah's crucial financial growth could be virtually unknown for more than a century after his service to the infant state. He was mentioned in Arrington's Great Basin Kingdom. President Woodruff once affirmed that Purbeck was the economic savior of Utah and the church. But Joseph Bennigan actually came closer to fulfilling that role. The power plant was completed in 1897, with it and the power transmission lines to Salt Lake City proving to be a major engineering achievement in the infant industry. The company, combined with others, including Big Cottonwood Power, became Union Light and Power, incorporated at $4.5 million, in which the first presidency owned over 18,000 shares. And then there's another incorporation just after that. And the first mortgage bonds are exchanged to Bennigan's heirs. And church leaders encourage these transactions because it relieves some immediate pressure for payment on original loans. Still, another complex reorganization took place in June 1899. And just weeks after that, President Cannon hurried east to negotiate with John Bennigan, executor of his father's estate, and worked out a refinance agreement with Bennigan. And in his memorandum about that, Cannon expressed relief at the power company officials' confidence they could meet continuing obligations and even more, and that the church thereby received, quote, release from the guarantee of $1.5 million in obligations that had been hanging over them for the previous 4 years. Similarly, in July 1898, the only church involvement in the sugar enterprise consisted of receiving dividends derived from its $8,500 shares of stock, then valued at $85,000. When the Utah-based company consolidated with others in the region to become Utah Idaho Sugar, the church not only approved but reportedly promoted this and continued to be involved. In 1957, the company was worth $20 million. The church reportedly owned 80% of the preferred stock and half the common stock. George Q. Cannon was probably the most accomplished and versatile Mormon leader of his generation. On his 70th birthday in 1897, President Woodruff described him as a smart, well-preserved man, able to do much work. He only lost the Senate seat when Utah became a state because of an ill-timed remark by Joseph F. Smith. And later that year, he met with President-elect William McKinley. And not long after that, Redfield Proctor, senator from Vermont and very close to McKinley, came out to Utah to try and talk Woodruff and others into electing George Q. Cannon to the other Utah seat that was then vacant. He doubtless would have been one of the outstanding statesmen of the era, which in fact he was from within the confines of his church position. He had masterminded the statehood effort even more completely than he had the economic rebuilding. On the other hand, partly because of his notorious impatience with dissent from other members of the Latter-day Saint hierarchy, and partly because of his seeming blindness to the abundant human frailties of Frank J. Cannon, much in evidence to other church authorities, the elder Cannon opened himself to rather severe criticisms among his fellows. This appeared particularly true when he wasn't present at some quarterly apostles' meetings. Partly because he was the chief advisor, some said dominant advisor, for so long to two aged church presidents, John Taylor and Wilford Woodruff, he was subject to two different extended criticism sessions when he wasn't present, wasn't a sinner, wasn't even an apostate, but was trying to fulfill his church callings as he understood them. It's noteworthy that among his critics on the second occasion were the next three presidents of the church, Lorenzo Snow, Joseph F. Smith, and Heber J. Graham. The decade-long resentments toward George Q. Cannon reemerged into open discussion at the end of 1897 when President Joseph F. Smith divulged to Heber J. Grant that Cannon blamed Grant for a $50,000 penalty relating to an old John W. Young railroad promotion debt that the church had to assume when it took that $250,000 loan back in 93 for the sugar factory. Offended, Grant in turn confessed he didn't have confidence in President Cannon's financial methods. And subsequently, that would even be more diminished because President Smith told him of other recent unnamed transactions. And the apostle soon discovered many of his fellows held similar opinions and feelings of distrust in regard to the way President Cannon was managing the financial affairs of the church through his son Frank, who was a U.S. senator and the logical one to represent them in the East. Grant went so far as to allege Cannon was putting words into the mouth of President Woodruff in some instances. It's clear that President Smith felt he had been left out of many Woodruff Cannon policy strategy discussions, and he later publicly complained of that fact soon after he became the new head of the church in 1901. These private conversations soon led to full discussion at a two-day apostles' meeting the first week of 1898. The proceedings commenced with Quorum President Lorenzo Snow affirming the first presidency possessed superior presiding prerogatives to those of his group and should be deferred to and sustained even if they erred in such matters to the extent of presumed misuse of church funds totaling $100,000. Apostles were said to have the right to express concern, but once decisions had been made by the presidency, the second highest level of church leaders were obligated to support the decisions without opposition. John Henry Smith noted, George Q. Cannon is one of the most talented men, conceding perhaps no man among us who is as gifted as he. He continued by asserting, George Q. Cannon was, quote, at present dominating the affairs of the church, end quote. The apostle rhetorically questioned if Woodruff on his own would have borrowed so much money for the Ogden Power Project, Salt Air, or the ill-fated Nevada Sterling Mine, answering his own queries that all knew that he would not have done so, lamenting Frank J. Cannon's involvement as a representative of the church. Smith speculated, President Cannon has assumed such great financial burdens as to cause him to plunge, presumably wildly or irresponsibly. Brigham Young Jr. termed Frank Cannon a drunk. and hoped the quorum would appeal to the presidency to correct the situation of him representing the church so prominently. He agreed with Smith that Woodruff depended on President Cannon, at least in all financial matters. Then Young correctly pointed out that since the apostles would have responsibility for these affairs should the first presidency be dissolved through death of the notably feeble Woodruff, they deserve to be more informed, if not involved, concerning these matters. Mariner Merrill pointedly warned that if church members learned tithing funds were being used to pay interest on debts, many would cease observing that major religious obligation. President Lorenzo Snow concluded the proceedings by observing that President Cannon well knew he did not approve of the methods of running into debt, erroneously concluding that nearly all of his schemes had been failures. The future LDS president then affirmed belief that God did not approve of such deficit financing methods, even for the benefit of the church, and agreed the presidency should share more information on financial matters with the apostles. By the end of the ensuing summer, President Woodruff was dead. With the first presidency dissolved, the apostles assumed responsibility for the presumably insolvent economic condition of the church. Presidents Cannon and Smith resumed their positions among the Quorum of the Twelve, but when Senior Apostle Lorenzo Snow reorganized the presidency more promptly than it had ever been done, he took the same counselors, which surprised Cannon, who well understood his disagreements with Snow on church financial matters. Just prior to Woodruff's last fatal trip to California, the presidency and seven apostles met with Frank Cannon to consider the advisability of raising bonds for $1.5 million if they could get it for an interest rate of 5% for the purpose of consolidating and funding the entire remaining church debt. Joseph F. Smith moved the church issue the bonds to pay off the indebtedness, and Lorenzo Snow seconded the motion. When, after not hearing from young Cannon for 2 months, President Snow concluded that the senator had obviously failed to sell the bonds, the church leader urged that something still needed to be done to raise sufficient funds to meet at least the current pressing obligations. He agreed it would be better to secure the funds among church members and Western friends instead of in the world, the East. In a similar meeting next day, someone finally asked President George Q. Cannon how much the church owed. He replied the amount to be $1.5 million, adding he assumed the church assets, including real estate, would then amount to over $3 million. Significantly, President Lorenzo Snow remarked, this is the first time he had ever heard the extent of the indebtedness of the church. Though clearly dismayed at the enormity of the obligations, Snow and his associates voted to issue three series of bonds for $500,000 each at 6% interest to mature in 11 years, but redeemable in 6 years. At the same time, the church leaders instituted a sinking fund through which at least $25,000 would be set aside annually to pay off these debts. After the group decided on the bond sales, as they discussed the sinking fund, George Q. Cannon moved that the yearly repayment fund be doubled to $50,000. Joseph F. Smith seconded that. Cannon affirmed the church to be, quote, abundantly able to put by a fund of twice that amount, end quote. But then President Snow reportedly spoke feelingly about the condition of the church financially and said nothing short of aid from God will cause us to get out of the financial swamp in which we are at the present time. At some point that day or the next, according to John Henry Smith's diary, President Snow did take Brother George Q. Cannon to task for the over-hopeful manner in which he'd spoken of our financial condition. Cannon's recent biographer, Davis Bitten, observed that the situation at the time, with understandable alarm over the financial perils of the church, it was easy for some to hold Cannon responsible. With hindsight, this seems unfair. But on the other hand, Cannon encouraged this hostility by so often acting arbitrarily, except for the ascent of Woodruff initiating the transactions for which his associates now criticized him and held him solely responsible. 3 days after this chastisement, Snow showed Heber J. Grant a list of assets of the church, eliciting a comment from the latter that he was surprised to find so high an estimated value placed on them, presumably by George Q. Cannon. Yet it can be cogently argued that these holdings were soon far more valuable than whatever the listed price, and eventually formed the basis for the amazingly extensive church financial holdings of later years. In a letter published in mid-December 1898 in the Deseret News, President Snow attempted explaining the current bond decision, falsely blaming government confiscation of church property for the entire church debt, and thus the need for the bond sales. Even without specific security, the first issue of bonds released in January 1899 sold within a few weeks, and the second $500,000 block offered a few days later was almost all taken up within the year. With the improved financial condition of the church and the nation, the depression's over by then, the third bond issue was unnecessary. With half the existing debt redeemed by remainder within 4 more years. It's doubtless true that Snow's famous Windows of Heaven tour to persuade Latter-day Saints to resume paying full tithing, along with the clear manifestations of economic recovery by then in progress in the region, assisted in resolving the church debt. But it must also be argued that the situation was already well on its way to resolution prior to Woodruff's death and according to George Q. Cannon's debt funding plans. The tragedy of Cannon's last years of relative ignominy was that he might have received due credit for his truly impressive economic crusade if President Woodruff had lived to see the refinance program he helped institute fully in place. But with Lorenzo Snow, Joseph F. Smith, and Heber J. Grant essentially molding public opinion on such subjects for the next half century as the leaders of the church, there was no chance for any such recognition, nor has the versatile canon received any acclaim for this aspect of his mission since then. In the immediate period of the bond sales, Lorenzo Snow and a substantial number of other Mormon general authorities who took their cue from the president of the church continued to regard Cannon as severely discredited and grossly in the wrong. This situation was intensified by the actions of Frank J. Cannon, whom Grant reported on January 5th, 1899, was drunk and frequenting a brothel. A month later, the increasingly unpopular Cannon, who had switched political allegiances, delivered a, quote, vile attack verbally on Mormon political activists John Henry Smith and Heber J. Grant, as well as, some insisted, the church itself. Grant hoped President Cannon would apologize in behalf of his son, but was disappointed. Later that spring, Snow again felt constrained to reiterate his dissatisfaction with George Q. Cannon's handling of church monies. Even 2 years later, at George Q. Cannon's funeral in late April 1900, President Snow publicly denied his first counselor had influenced him in any recent decisions regarding church leadership. This was certainly a strongly negative note on which to end the career of such a significant and productive servant of a series of 4 presidents of the LDS Church, including Brigham Young, whom he had revered as prophets of God. George Q. Cannon certainly stands as the most important Latter-day Saint leader in the process, which many opposed, of bringing Mormondom closer to the mainstream of American political and economic life at the turn of the 20th century. In large part, George Q. Cannon proved correct, not only in the need for a financial program such as he spearheaded, but that it had, to a considerable extent, succeeded. It may be impossible to determine conclusively at this late date When the church acquired most of the securities held throughout the ensuing century, but it can be surmised that a large proportion of at least Utah Power and Light, Utah Idaho Sugar, and Union Pacific Railroad stemmed from the time when Cannon, among others, loomed preeminent in fashioning a new financial empire. But with the firm opposition he engendered, there was no way the longtime first counselor could be exonerated from the criticisms leveled at him or praised for his great contributions in economic matters then or perhaps later. He has thus been denied recognition for a significant mission to which he devoted the major portion of the last half dozen years of his eventful life. Thank you. Maybe I read 40 pages too fast, but we've got time for a few questions. Yes. It supposedly started with a failure in London. Yes, it's mainly worldwide, and maybe British Empire stimulated. Yes, Jess. If the panic caught them, then it's before George Q. Cannon's grandiose schemes. So I'm not really sure about that. You can go ahead and blame him. It's not going to hurt him. Yes. I am not criticizing Davis Bitten. I honor him for the job he did, although it was one of my lifelong goals with Ron Walker to be that biographer. He didn't hardly touch this stuff. Let me tell you the story of where this material came from. Back in the olden days, 1972 or 3, there was a transfer of First Presidency financial papers to the Church Historian's Office, and I saw them and recognized how valuable they were and talked into a tape recorder for more than a week, and then had some poor little high school girls who were slaves transcribe that. 67 legal-size, single-space pages of financial notes on the 1890s. And it's not fair for me to quote that when it's not available. I'm going to put a copy of it down in the boondocks, Southern Utah State University. But there will be a copy of those papers down there. Yes. Well, in Political Deliverance, Franklin S. Richards is the main attorney in the early years when the Democrats are still in charge in Washington, D.C., and when President Cannon's still a Democrat. But he basically fades from the picture by the time Benjamin Harrison's elected in the fall of 88, and Cannon becomes a Republican by 1890. But Franklin S. Richards is a very important representative of the church. Yes, sir. I have always heard stories of Uncle Jesse. The only things I see, I just did a paper on the financial exhaustion of Wilford Woodruff in his last years to a Tonopah mining conference. It's an international mining conference, but it was out in Tonopah, and those guys courteously listened. But one of the things I saw was just a tremendous number of debts falling due. Leonard Arrington's last article I co-authored on a gold mine in southern Nevada that they'd put $250,000 in. And then the expert said, if you'll just put $37,000 more into more equipment and getting a better water supply, we can basically assure you $70,000 a year. And President Woodruff wouldn't even touch it. He was just sick of all of the debts. And some of them were Brigham Young Academy going broke, Utah County State not being able to handle it. And it was Jesse Knight's loans to the church that basically saved what became BYU at that time. And I believe the church sort of took responsibility for that academy at that time. And that's all I know. I know that they think he walks on water down there, don't they, Duane? Is that all of the questions? Thank you very much.